Hey everybody, my name is Patrick Bromley. Welcome to the F This Movie commentary track for Revenge of the Ninja from 1983. As you can see, taking place in Tokyo, Japan, just in case the setting wasn't clue enough for you. Of course, this is a canon movie, which means I love it. They were the champions of exploitation movies in the 1980s. We'll talk about canon again in a little bit. You can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com in case you're new to our little endeavor. I'm actually on my own today for the first time. This is sort of an experiment because typically we record podcasts about movies in groups of two, sometimes three. But for this commentary on Revenge of the Ninja, I'm actually recording. I'm flying solo for the first time ever. So I apologize if this is a little slow or quiet or boring, but this movie is amazing and it needs to be talked about. I'll try not to pause too much. Usually there would be somebody else to fill in these spaces, so you'll have to forgive me. You know, I typically have a no-eating policy on If This Movie. We try not to eat or drink while we're recording, but because I'm on my own, I have some popcorn here, which I'm going to use as a crutch the way I usually use heroin in my day-to-day life. I also have some Monster Energy drink, the blue flavor, the official beverage of F This Movie. Here are the first look at the ninjas. Now, these are not the ninjas who are taking revenge. That ninja will show up later. So this movie came out in 1983. It is a sequel to a movie called Enter the Ninja, which starred Franco Nero, the sort of man's man star of a ton of Italian exploitation movies. He was the title character in Django, directed by Sergio Corbucci, one of my very favorite spaghetti westerns. I might have to get back to the history of Enter the Ninja in just a second, because these ninjas are about to fuck some people up. Again, the whole thing about ninjas, I thought, was that they attacked from the shadows, that they would kill you without you sort of even realizing that they're there. And yet here's a bunch of ninjas straight up running around in broad daylight, killing this guy in unison, which is very nice. Why the outfits? I don't really know. What are they hiding? It's bright daylight. Not cool. Fucking this lady up here. This is an insanely violent movie. In fact, when it came out on when it came out on, all right, take it easy, guys. When it came out on VHS, initially, there were a bunch of edits, including this scene right here, cut out. Seriously, Chinese throwing star to the head of a 10-year-old boy. So that did not make the cut on the VHS version. Thankfully, it's been restored for the DVD, or if you're watching this on Netflix, this is the fully restored version. I don't know. I mean, the kid gets a Chinese throwing star to the head. The young girl, who's actually the wife of the main character who we're seeing right now, showing up, Cho, played by Sho Kasugi, gets sort of this very gentle arrow to the chest. Listen, I'm not saying I want an arrow to the chest, everyone, but I don't know, it just seems odd that the kid gets the most brutal death of everyone. So here we're seeing Sho Kasugi, who plays Cho, for the first time. And I can't confirm that his dialogue has been dubbed. It certainly appears that way, because the words don't always match up, obviously, with his mouth movements. And if it was dubbed, if this is the way he talks, then that's fine. But if it was dubbed, it appears to be dubbed by a Caucasian man doing a vaguely racist impression of sort of a Japanese ninja. If you pay close attention to the accent that's being used, I do not believe that that's the way that Sho Kasugi talks. I could be wrong. So Enter the Ninja comes out in 81, starring Franco Nero. And again, in the 70s, he played all these cops in these Italian exploitation movies, and he was great. If you wanted someone to play a cop, and it was the 70s, and you were in Italy, you called Franco Nero, and it made sense. But in 81, when you wanted someone to play a ninja, Franco Nero was maybe not your first choice. Yes, it's definitely a throwing star. Oh, he just killed another kid when he threw that ninja star off screen. A different child died. So having Franco Nero play a ninja is akin to having like Gene Hackman play a ninja. It just didn't make sense. But I guess the movie warranted a sequel basically because Menachem Golan and Joern Globus, who ran Canon, were basically just trying to exploit the ninja craze of the early 80s. So there's a sequel, Revenge of the Ninja. There's also a part 3, Ninja 3, The Domination. That's not fair. You don't bring a gun to a ninja fight, Sean Connery. None of the three ninja movies, look at that. That's how good he is. He catches that shit in his teeth and then stabs the guy with the arrows. This movie is amazing, by the way. Look at how uncomfortable this guy seems to be with physical activity. So there's three ninja movies that come out. And none have anything to do with one another, except for they're all produced by Canon. They all have ninja in the title. And they all star Sho Kasugi. However, he's not playing the same character in all three movies. In the first movie, he's the villain. In Enter the Ninja, he's the villain because Franco Nero is the hero. In this one, obviously, he's the hero, Cho. In the third movie, Ninja 3, The Domination, he's a ninja. That's a weird sort of German. No, okay, I'm sorry. This is ninja speak. That one's Donatello. That one is Storm Shadow. Again, why they all choose to attack one at a time, and when their first attack is unsuccessful, so they jump by him, they swing the sword, he blocks it, right? Where did the smoke come from? And then I love that ninja, that he wasn't where the smoke needed to be, so he flat out fucking backs up into the smoke screen, like, oh shit, the smoke was back there, and he backs up into the smoke screen. This movie is filled with moments like that, and that's why I thought it perfect for a commentary. I just hope I could do it justice. Again, now these guys are the bad guys. These are some bad motherfuckers, right? They somehow get these sort of bloodless deaths. Let me remind you, the 10-year-old got the throwing star in the head that then his father pulled out of his forehead. This man pulled a Chinese throwing star out of his son's forehead, looked at it, and then threw it off camera. And somehow these guys get these boring, bloodless deaths. So in Ninja 3, The Domination, Sho Kasugi plays a ninja who dies, and his spirit inhabits the body of an aerobics instructor, played by Lucinda Dickey. And that was the movie I actually saw growing up a lot as a kid. And all I remember from it is, wait a minute. These dead bodies weren't here when I left. Was at one point Lucinda Dickey pours V8 vegetable juice on her boobs and lets her boyfriend lick it off. And as a kid, I remember thinking, do girls do that? And also, do I need to start drinking vegetable juice? Because it would never occur to me otherwise. Unless it was on the chest of Lucinda Dickey, who's a fox. And Sam Furstenberg actually directed this movie, Revenge of the Ninja, also Ninja 3, The Domination, and worked with Lucinda Dickey again in Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo. She does not pour vegetable juice on her tits in that movie. Now that is a mockingjay, the symbol of the rebellion. This is Cho's cop friend, whose name is Braden, and he's played by Arthur Roberts. What I'm saying is don't trust this asshole. And now here's the sort of Asian stereotype, Mockingjay. That is one of the shortest women I've ever seen in my life. again, she's sort of playing a stereotype as well. But that's the great thing about these canon movies, is that they're, like, exploiting these ideas that they actually know very little about. Yeah, you might as well come too. Cho, a word, please. So Brayden wants Cho. Well, yeah, I don't trust him either now with that, with a fucking zoom on his eyes like that. He's not meant to be trusted. So I have no idea why Brayden suggests that they go to America to open a gallery. Cho apparently is a ninja, and yet somehow Brayden thinks he would make a terrific art gallery owner. I'm going to eat some popcorn now, so part. Wait, here comes, American flag. United States, there it is. Again, there's no one whose intelligence this movie will not insult, and that's part of what I love about it. Now here's Ernie Reyes Jr., star of Sidekicks. Just kidding, everyone. That's Kane Kasugi playing Kane, Cho's son. You could tell it's 6 years later because Cho's mother has gone totally gray. So his real-life son, Kane, is playing Kane, his son in the movie. And apparently there were gang members of six-year-olds in America in 1983. Your plan is to ram him with your bike. I feel that the grandmother should intervene, but I don't know what she's going to do. Really. Here, quick. Let's move over to this part of the woods. Again, the plan. Let us attack him one at a time. When you see that he's kicked your friend's ass, why do you then run in and think that your luck will be any different? I don't know, but it's fun to watch a six-year-old be, oh, look at that, a dirty fighter. A dirty fighter, that is not the way of the ninja, young Kane. I don't know where he came from, but he's a ninja. He can sort of appear from anywhere. He's not fighting in the street. He's fighting in the woods. More wisdom from Cho's mother. Teach him the way of the ninja. Here she is with that goddamn Mockingjay again. I love that they keep cutting to it. Just a straight up close up of that. I feel like maybe this woman never talks about anything else, but I don't know. I don't live with her. So it's taken 6 years, and they've opened a gallery now, and they sell dolls. Because everyone will go to a doll gallery in America to buy dolls from a former ninja. Now, Cho has sworn off the way of the ninja. So he will not teach his son in the way of the ninja because he's not happy about the family dying. Keep in mind, at some point, he will take revenge. It is the revenge of the ninja. We have some more terrible dubbing here. And again, I don't watch a movie like this, ironically, I swear. Here we have the first appearance of Kathy, who comes for her practice not wearing pants. Somehow this kid is not distracted at all by the pantsless woman watching him in the background. But she wears a headband, so we know she's ready to practice. I don't know, Kane's got skills, is what I'm saying. No time for love, Dr. Jones. No time for love. I don't watch these movies ironically. Like, I'm not sitting here thinking, oh my god, this movie is so idiotic, and let me sit here and goof on it for an hour and a half, even if I kind of am goofing on it a little bit. But, like, these touches that are sort of funny, like the dude backing up into the smoke. Those are the things that I love about the movie, because the movie is sincere. I mean, you know, I wrote a column about Break-In 2 at our website, fthismovie.blogspot.com, a couple weeks ago. And I pointed out that, you know, it was sort of born of cynicism because it was teach her the way, Cho. Teach her the way of your dick. Listen, I didn't have a better joke there, okay? And if somebody else was here with me, they could have chimed in and maybe had a different word for dick. I just went with the most obvious. I just went dick. I always just go dick. The movies are born of cynicism. They're sort of trying to exploit these ideas, whether it's breakdancing in the break-in movies or ninjas. Well, ninjas are a popular thing. Let's make some ninja movies. But everyone involved, you know, is really trying to make the best possible movie. And that's the thing, you know, when people shit on Plan 9 from Outer Space or Ed Wood's movies or something, like, that guy lived to make movies. By the way, we have a podcast on Plan 9 from Outer Space, which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com or in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie. I'm going to keep shamelessly self-promoting because sometimes these commentaries get picked up by weird third-party sites who maybe don't know about F This Movie, and I must spread the word. I must teach you the way. Have sex with her, you dummy. Ed Wood lived to make movies. They were everything to him, and so I just don't see how you could, I mean, that passion comes across in every one of his movies. Now, he wasn't very good at it, and that's, I guess, what the disconnect is, and that's why people laugh at what he made. But we are unpacking the dolls right now, by the way, he just said. Here are crates that they are pulling dolls out of, and yet he has to tell them that they're unpacking them right now. I like the thing on the wall, the decoration on the wall, because it looks kind of like a butt. Some of that I think is true of a lot of these canon movies. Again, they're born of cynicism, but you know, Sam Furstenberg is doing his best to make a really good ninja action movie. He's not doing a great job at it. The writing is bad, and the acting isn't great, and the fight choreography is kind of ridiculous at times. I mean, yes, by all measurable standards, like, Revenge of the Ninja is a bad movie, but it's so super entertaining, and it means so well that I like it in spite of its sort of badness, you know? Again, the guy doing the dubbing for Shokasugi is so bad. I guess he's a leftover from, like, the old Godzilla movies, because it's really offensive. I don't know. If you're a Japanese person, it's okay to be offended by the dubbing. Oh. Okay. Now, here we have a thing that I have never done in my goddamn life, but they do it in movies all the time. Oh, okay, so I love this. So we fade to black, right, in the gallery, and then we fade back up, back in the gallery, totally different day, because somebody decided, like, oh, we need Kane to discover the heroine. So we're in the gallery, we fade out of the gallery, we fade back into the gallery, different day, different characters, just so he can discover that they're actually importing heroin in the dolls, in their doll gallery. This is an important plot point. What I was going to say was that woman back there, she cut her finger on the little ninja doll sword, and her immediate response was to stick it in her mouth and, like, suck the blood. People do this in movies and TV all the time. Maybe people do this in their, whoa, heroin doll. Maybe people do this in their real lives. I don't know. But that is never my instinct. She straight up says, and the heroin spilled out, not the product. just in case there's anyone in the audience who doesn't know, A, that we're in the United States, and B, that what they're importing is heroin. Kathy tends to turn her head to the side when she talks, perhaps because she feels like it maximizes her beauty. By the way, it totally does. Alright, so spoilers coming up for Revenge of the Ninja. By the way, this movie's supposed to take place, I believe, in Los Angeles. Clearly shot in Utah, and in fact, throughout the movie you can see Utah license plates. Ah, here we have the mobsters on loan from Central Casting. These guys are very, very ridiculous. And again, this is like the kind of interpretation of mobsters that you get only if you've seen movies about mobsters and maybe English is not your first language. Like, and this is how mobsters are, right? In the United States with the American flag. And so this is how you cast your movie, and this is how you ask these guys to play this part. Sometimes I feel like the actor playing Braden maybe was like a dentist yesterday and then somehow got the part in this movie. He never really feels comfortable on screen. But if you slapped a mustache on him, he would basically be Franco Nero in Enter the Ninja. Wow, $100? That doesn't seem like that much money. So the fact that Braden goes on to be like the number two ninja in the movie, spoilers for Revenge of the Ninja, is about as convincing as when Franco Nero does it in the first movie. Oh, I'm sorry, it's $100,000. $100,000. That's very different. Tell your goons to move so I can walk out the window? What are they blocking? I'm completely wrapped up in this movie now. I'm so sorry. You can tell that he's serious again because he's... Oh! There we have this scary... there we have this scary cut to his eyes again for the second time. Crazy time jump there. We're in the middle of that scene. All of a sudden we cut to this where he's packing his ninja gear. He wears this metal mask every time he goes out to kill the mob. Oh, there it is again. They just keep going back to that shot, which I like. In case you haven't figured out that Braden is evil. Now he's going to interrupt the mobster picnic. Deal or no deal? How he knew to find this mobster at this particular rest stop is beyond me. I don't know. And again, why the metal mask? So that they, I guess so they think he's Japanese and they don't figure out. This would not be my reaction if I was peeing and I turned around and there was a ninja in front of me. My immediate reaction would not be, what is this, Halloween? What, pay close attention. A, to the fact that his neck is broken, and then he continues to move and breathe, and yeah, there we go. Now he's finally dead. The editing in this movie, very little of it actually matches up, which is just another one of its charms, I think. But again, there's plenty of people that don't have time for this kind of movie, and if you're a fan of this kind of movie, you know, this Revenge of the Ninja has so much to offer, but you really have to have the patience for it. Here's a very weird subplot in which the mobsters use this weird one-eyed sort of homeless guy as their informant. The reason for him wearing the eye patch will become evident shortly. There's a reason for it. You'll see. Back into the suitcase of goodies for Brayden. He chooses this. Oh, look at that. Right in the eye patch. And then he falls into the fountain in slow motion. Now, there's absolutely no reason why they would kill the homeless man informant before he would kill the actual mobsters. But again, I don't think Brayden's plan is totally thought out. Here we get the close-up of the aftermath of the throwing star in the eyeball. Yeah, there it is. So that's why we had the eye patch, so that we could put that elaborate prosthetic on the homeless dude. Coming up, I believe we have one of the only nude scenes in Revenge of the Ninja. This is when apparently Michael Myers looks at pornography. So whoever is in this hotel room watching TV, looking at porn, sleeping in the bed, eating my porridge. This is just all padding, basically. Okay, so here we are now in the hot tub. We're wiping out, basically, this whole mob in a very short amount of time, so you have to wonder. And every time we go back into the suitcase, by the way, we have to get the shot of him choosing the weapon. It's almost like a video game, like a first-person shooter kind of a thing. I don't actually know, because I don't really play video games. Speaking of which, you know, in the 80s, ninjas were the shit. In the early 80s, you had, now we have some blowgun damage coming up. Again, I've never been shot with a blowgun. I don't know why it would do that to your back the instant the little dart hit you. Are we supposed to think that it has something to do with the poison that is attached to the blowgun? Or I don't know, but for some reason, it makes a nasty... look at how sloppy these people are. Not cool, guys. Not fucking cool. The early 80s, man, you had Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes on the G.I. Joe cartoon, and they were the two most awesome characters. If you had a friend who had, like, a Sega Genesis, you probably played a shitload of Shinobi, like I did. Although I probably just watched him play Shinobi, because my move was never to actually play the video game, but I was great at sitting next to my friend and watching him play the game. I'm more of a watcher, less of a doer. This explains my my love of movies, perhaps. I could have gone out, learned how to be a ninja, taken revenge myself. I prefer to watch someone else do it, is my point. Here's a weird line of dialogue. The coroner said it's going to take a jackhammer to tear them apart, right? They were hit with a blowgun. Then they drowned. Why are they fused together? Is this something like when a fat person like sits on their couch too long and it starts to attach to them? I mean, they weren't in the water that long. So why it will take a jackhammer? Unless it's a commentary on their love, which is really kind of sweet, and now it actually makes me kind of sad that that they were killed. Now we meet this guy, who's Cho's white friend, who will factor into the movie later. Dave Hatcher is his name, I'm sorry. He shows up later on. He's sort of the prototype for Jeff Speakman, otherwise known as the Perfect Weapon. And again, the great thing about exploitation movies, and I happen to be a huge fan of exploitation movies, is they're constantly trying to deliver. So it doesn't want to slow down, you know, long enough for a lot of, like, dialogue and exposition. So you have that scene where Dave Hatcher is teaching a class and just fucking guys up in his class. Just because it's been, like, a few minutes since we had any action. And it doesn't matter that the action that we get is shitty. That it's, like, unconvincing stunt work done in what is supposed to be a karate studio, but really just looks like they shot in front of an abandoned building with a brick wall. It doesn't matter that the action is shitty. It's like, well, it's been a couple minutes since we had any fighting. Let's show some of that. And again, I admire that. I admire a movie that wants to deliver what it promises, because there are a lot of movies that don't made today. That's a funny line. That's a funny line. He says, there were a group in Japan, they were bone breakers, which I love. Like, oh, well, this group of, they were specifically able to break bones. There was a group of bone breakers in Japan about 300 or 400 years ago, and the cop's response is, no, I'm thinking Thursday at 11. That's an intentionally funny line that Revenge of the Ninja comes up with. Most of the laughs in this movie are of the unintentional variety. So again, we're back to some sparring, just so we can get some more fighting, because it's been a couple minutes since we saw Dave Hatcher beat those other guys up. So now we get Dave Hatcher and Cho sparring. I really do genuinely love this movie. So now Cho has been brought in as like a ninja advisor. Somebody explain something to me about this guy. Why does he have two yogurts in front of him? He literally finished a yogurt and then thought, I want to have a second yogurt? And is it like an important plot point? Because why wouldn't some set decorator said, hey, let's take one of those yogurts out of the frame. Let's just have him as a guy who eats one yogurt at a time. The gate of the eyes, can it reach the brain and kill my 10-year-old son? On camera. Once again, if you're keeping score, the 10-year-old son has the most violent death in the movie thus far. That will change. No time for love, Dr. Jones. Look at those lightning-fast reflexes. The coffee cup that you didn't quite see knocked off the desk in the last shot. Cho caught it. No mention of the two yogurts. I'm not suggesting that, like, she should have just slept with him, right? It's obviously her prerogative. But I don't understand how she gets in a position where she's in, like, a negligee and garters sitting on the couch with him, and he's shirtless, and yet she's like, I don't want to mess around. I'm not saying, like, you have to mess around just because you're dressed that way, but how did it get to that point, I guess, is what I'm wondering. It doesn't matter. Let's move on. The movie's moving on. It's not going to slow down to answer questions like the yogurt question or the Kathy Underpants question. We spend a lot of time... Oh, here we go. Here's one of my favorite characters in the movie. The offensive Native American stereotype. So weird, fake future Joe Pesci is saying. Yeah, he tells them to scalp them. Because again, that's as much as we know about Native Americans. They dress like this, they scalp people. What they left out, obviously, was the smallpox-infected blanket. I believe this is Professor Toru Tanaka, who would go on to play Sub-Zero in The Great Running Man. Now, of course, just plain Zero. And then I think... Oh, no, I'm confusing him with somebody else. The dude from the Austin Powers. Okay, here's a question. Where was that guy? He pops up into frame, I get, because it makes, you know... for a good shot, but where was he before that shot started? Literally just crouching down, and why? And why are those things in cases if they're so easy to take? There's no security at this place. Until Cho shows up in what I believe is an El Camino to take revenge. The Revenge of the Ninja. You know the one from the title? Okay, you remember the title of the movie? There's the butt again. Here we have maybe our most extended action scene since that opening fight. This thing goes on for a while. Because that van, let me tell you something, it's not going to stay stationary for long, I guess, is my point. Oh, another broken neck. Getting all wrapped up in the fight. I don't mean to. Oh, here's Chief. My temptation, honestly, is to, like, do some sort of offensive Native American voice, but I would just sink down to this movie's level, so I'm not going to. But honestly, like, what were they thinking? All the fights in the movie feel very choreographed. You know, sometimes you had these movies that were shitty. The guy doesn't... Okay, that's another one of my favorite. That's right there with the ninja that backs up into the smoke. The guy hops into the van, clearly isn't going to make it. He starts to fall out, but it cuts away. And in the next shot, he's climbing into the van. But it's very obvious that had the camera been allowed to run a little bit longer, he would have just fallen back out of the van. And I love that they're like, no, we're not going to do a second take of that. That makes no physical sense. He came to a stop before he flipped over that wall. And again, this would all be super impressive if any of it were allowed to play out in like a slightly longer master shot. Like, oh, look what he can actually do. You know, that's what makes Jackie Chan movies so entertaining is that we're able to see him actually do some of these things. When they cut it up into five or six different little quick clips, you can make it look like I can do this shit, you know, if you'll cut it up 12 different times, if I just need to do 10 little jumps. Now we have a fight in a moving van, which I like. What I was going to say earlier was, you know, a lot of these movies, even when they were shitty, they had amazing action because you had these, you know, guys who were professional stuntmen or guys who were professional fighters, guys who really knew, you know, karate and stuff. And because they were working on these sort of low-budget exploitation movies, a lot of times not in the United States, in countries with laws that were far more lax, there's a real feeling of danger to some of the things they're doing. Like, oh, they probably shouldn't be doing what they're doing. And that makes the movie. I don't understand how that works either. They bump into another car and they all just fall out of the van. And now we're going to fight in the street. Chief very shortly is going to produce two tomahawks. There we go. Again, because he's Native American, in case you didn't already know. And that's what they fight with. Tomahawks. He's going to scalp Cho for much wampum. How they decided to make this guy. And that's it for Chief, by the way. His neck is broken. He has such sort of an unceremonious death. He shows up and you really think, like, okay, this guy's going to be a heavy hitter. He's going to be, like, the number two henchman. Cho is so fast, he can dodge bullets from just feet away by doing somersaults and shit. Now he's just ducking. So why the decision to make him this stereotypical Native American, I don't know. The only thing I can figure is maybe somebody had just read Firestarter. Because I think the movie came out the same year where George C. Scott plays a Native American, which is a little bit like having Franco Nero play a ninja. I need something to drink. Hold on. I'm worn out. So, you know, here we had a guy really do this. Not Shokasugi, but that's okay. He's a star. That's a dummy, obviously. Again, 8 different cuts. The thing about Sam Furstenberg, he's not a great director. But he's like the guy for the job, you know what I mean? And I love that. There's these guys who got hired again and again to do these cheap exploitation movies, oftentimes, you know, with canon. They're like these directors for hire, and they have a very specific style. It's a shitty style, but they bring it to everything they do. And so if you're a student of these kinds of movies, you can go through and watch several Sam Furstenberg movies and see, oh yeah, he does these things over and over again. And it's fun to see that. I hesitate to call the guy an auteur, because I don't think he's bringing any of his own personal shit to the movie. Maybe he is. Maybe he had a kid who was killed by a throwing star at age 10. I don't know. So now we have Braden showing up to attack Cho's mother. Again, and maybe I need to be paying closer attention to the plot. Why Braden is systematically killing both the gangsters and Cho's family, I don't totally understand, but he must have an endgame in mind. He must. He doesn't know that the ninja's going to take revenge. If it were me, I would climb the ladder. I would see where that shit goes. Probably to a helicopter. Where I could fly away to safety. Now, if she had just stayed hidden, she might not end up where she ends up. Okay, now this is... Come on. I don't even think that's supposed to be funny. I really don't. But how are we supposed to take that any other way? She's like Margaret Cho doing a character. She's not, you know, a believable human being. It's like someone sat down. Oh, here we go, another smoke bomb. And she vanished. Ninjas can do that. They know the way. The way of the ninja. It's almost as if someone sat down and made a list of, like, what are all the weapons that a ninja uses And then throughout the... Oh, killed through the paper wall. Not cool. And guess what? Second bloodiest death in the movie? Cho's fucking mom. What is going on? Why are the most brutal deaths reserved for his loved ones? Why not see, like, some of these bad guys really get fucked up? And we have another zoom in on Brayden. There you go. Cut the rope, kid. What I like about Kane is that he's always thinking. So somebody sat down and made a list of, like, all the ninja weapons that somebody would use. On the... weapons that a ninja would use, and then so every time they introduce a new one, we get sort of this very deliberate lingering shot of the person producing the weapon, and then we see what it does. You know, we see the weapon in action, and then we get to see the aftermath. It's like going to ninja school, but way more awesome than school. Again, these ninjas, I feel like they're the worst ninjas in ninjadom. They're just constantly running around in broad daylight where anybody could see them. Not that people are seeing this guy, you know, on top of the roof. But no one attacks from the shadows, and then he kicks the bucket. Not literally. He's still very much alive. But I love the pouting ninja. Damn it. She's sitting on some sort of thing with wheels there, I feel like, because she couldn't reach the floor. Oh, this goddamn Mockingjay pin again. She's now a symbol for the rebellion. I promise to stop making that joke. I'm so sorry. But she really is reduced to her necklace. Part of him is secretly happy because now he gets it. She promised it to him. When I die, you'll get this. So he's like, ah, fuck. This is bittersweet. But, you know, finders keepers, Mom. I think it's at this point that he's pretty ready for revenge. I can't be sure. But he's pretty ready. It's an interesting decision, too, to have the cops as part of the story, because really they serve no function. You could just as easily have Cho sort of take matters into his own hands, which is what he's going to do, have it be between him and Brayden the whole time, because, you know, in another movie you might have sort of the subplot where the cops are trying to track down not just Brayden, but Cho as well. You see that a lot sort of in contemporary action movies where there's a good guy and a bad guy, and then the cops are basically trying to hunt them both down, or even like a fucking Spider-Man movie or whatever, you know. Sub-Zero wants to get it on with Kathy, who's now showing her boobs. This is now the second and I believe final nude scene in the movie. And the guy doesn't stop. Did he not see the ninja there? I understand. I mean, he's wearing black. Oh, Sub-Zero. Now, plain Zero. I love all the exposition, too, delivered from behind the mask. So really, they could just dub in any dialogue they want. This is a fun game that they play, where they count together. Really, he's hypnotizing her, which, by the way, is that something a ninja can do? All of a sudden, ninjas have mind power, too? Oh, he's got mind power because he has the glowing green eye. You gotta love a movie that's just willing to constantly invent new rules for itself. Demonstrative finger point. So Kathy has now become sort of a reluctant slave to do Braden's bidding. She didn't want to get Cho. She didn't want to get Kane. Now she has to. And see that shot, like, it's very deliberately lit, you know, from the back there, and there's, you know, smoke everywhere. You can tell that Sam Furstenberg, like, is trying to do something. It's not completely artless. I mean, it kind of is, because the movie's so clumsy. But, like, here's a guy trying to make a movie. Like, he really... now Cho has to go talk to the village people to learn the whereabouts of... It's hard for me to choose a favorite in that group. It's not that hard, because really the answer is Cowboy, because what the fuck is going on with that guy? But I do like the black guy with the headphones on, too. It was the 80s. Black people constantly listening to music. Constantly. Sometimes they had their radios. This guy just has a headphone. But what is better than that cowboy, honestly? I'd watch a whole movie about that guy. It's been, you know, a few minutes since a fight. Where did that... Oh, I guess I know where he came from, but... How did they get down here all of a sudden? You know what I mean? I really am sorry for being so quiet. Have I said that I'm on my own? Be much easier, you know, if there was somebody here with me. I could make jokes and they wouldn't laugh. And then there'd still be the uncomfortable silence. But it would mean more because it would be like a tense, uncomfortable silence instead of just a boring, uncomfortable silence, if that makes sense. There's a difference. There's definitely a difference. Is this a playground that they're on? Because it seems awfully dangerous for children. And also, why are these four guys hanging out at a playground? What are they doing? This doesn't really seem the kind of thing that was, like, written into the script. This seems like the kind of thing that they found a location one day. Like, oh, where's Cho gonna have his fight with the village people? And then they found a location, and then they choreographed it sort of as they were going. Like, oh, how about that playground? And then they kind of choreographed it and shot it all on the same day. I mean, that was a kick that just did not land at all. And then the guy's already back up. Kick him in the tube. There we go. There he goes. Oh, that's what did it. Cowboy seems to have some some on-again, off-again issues with his sunglasses, if you pay attention. And now he lost half his mustache. Almost all of his power was in that mustache. So he's kind of like Superman in Superman 2 right now. Just fucking fighting on fumes. No powers. But he's not giving up. Ken Foray appears out of nowhere, starts shooting at people. He has a throwing star belt buckle. Now again, we've seen the size of that throwing star. We know that his hand is not actually pinned to that post, right? I'm sure it hurt. Clearly, I mean, the guy seemed to be in pain. But to try and convince us that somehow his hand is pinned to that post, it's more than I can suspend my disbelief, everyone. In the past, you know, we've done commentaries for Sleepaway Camp, the Robert Hiltzik slasher movie, and Reindeer Games, the Ben Affleck Christmas action movie. I would advise you to check those two out. They're better than this one. Not the movie. This, honestly, Sleepaway Camp is a movie exactly like this. It's so goddamn entertaining. It makes so many weird choices. It's so incompetently made. But everyone involved means it. And I love that. This is sort of the Sleepaway Camp of action movies, I think. Minus some of the weird sexual politics of Sleepaway Camp. There's another level on which that movie is fascinating. And this movie doesn't have a lot of that. But stylistically and sort of tone-wise, there's a lot of similarities between this and Sleepaway Camp. How many movies do you get to see where, like, a very pretty blonde lady fights a six-year-old for, like, a long time? It's not just, like, a quick thing where he is subdued by her, or he's trying to outrun her. Like, they're flat-out fucking fighting and beating each other up. And it keeps going. Where did that flip get him? I have no idea. This fight scene is still on, between the blonde lady and the six-year-old. This is a movie filled with crazy ideas about what belongs in a movie. Again, everything's so choreographed, though. There's no spontaneity to any of the fights. How great would it be if he just killed her? I mean, you can tell that she's worried he's going to, because she has her worried face on. So instead, he just turns his back. Again, character, and the scene could have ended. I mean, the scene could have started right there with her just picking him up. And if it was that fucking easy just to pick him up and run off with him, why did we just have a 5-minute fight scene between a hot blonde lady and a 6-year-old? Did she say he's only a child or he's an only child? Because both are true. I saw his older brother get a throwing star in the forehead earlier in this movie. Back to the gangsters. In the back is Billy Crystal during the soap era. Some more weapons that we haven't seen yet. Now, Raphael carries those. If you're a Ninja Turtle fan. And of course you are. And that's kind of, you know, what happened with, like, ninjas was by the end of the 80s, they were co-opted into cute kids cartoons where they, you know, ate pizza and skateboarded. But in 83, man, being a ninja was bloody business. Do you even own a robe like that if you're not, like, a mob boss? Like, is there just some dude who's, like, a fucking gas station attendant who owns a robe like that? By the way, now the mob guys are just carrying around these giant-ass machine guns. This is where Michael Mann got the idea for Heat, by the way. Again, in broad daylight. Everybody does shit in daylight in this movie. No scenes take place at night. I literally don't think this has ever occurred to me, but I don't think there's any scenes that take place at night in this movie. Here's the reveal now. Kathy is telling Cho everything. It's taken us a really long time to get to this point. But now, finally, we can have the revenge of the ninja. Kathy's only function, really, in the movie is to be pretty and deliver exposition. She does great at both. And how did Brayden become a ninja without Cho knowing? What I'm saying is, Revenge of the Ninja, it asks questions it's not willing to answer. By the way, Brayden and Kane, this movie's actually way ahead of its time in terms of its names, because those would totally be kids' names now. Which leads me to believe, oh, well, he's a ninja because he lived for 20 years in Japan. So I guess Cho did know that he had some ninja abilities. And now again, we're ruling out the police, which is fine, because I don't really... Only a ninja can stop a ninja. There's your lesson for this movie, by the way. Only a ninja can stop a ninja. Okay. We're over an hour into this thing, and finally, we're going to have some ninja revenge. Now, Kathy knows that Brayden is the ninja, right? And now... Because his dialogue is all clearly dubbed via, like, ADR after the fact, he's very demonstrative with his hands, and it kind of reminds me of, like, Spectreman. We must kill Spectreman. Like, you have to move your hands with every word that you say. They went a little crazy with the steam in this sequence because you almost can't see anything. And, Kathy's is the first ever death by jacuzzi jet attempted in a movie. And Kane is in a sauna. So it's kind of neat. He's using a spa, you know, for evil purposes. It doesn't happen that often. Except the death spa from 1985. The place was full of weapons, right? When Kane and Kathy were fighting, they were picking up weapons. They were practically tripping over fucking weapons. So why do we have this secret weapon thing? And why, again, is it fucking smoking? Why does everything smoke in this movie? Why is his uniform smoking? Try and read that expression on his face. Is it, I'm going to take revenge? Is it, I'm hungry? again with the smoke, but here I'll buy it because he's obviously in his little, I don't know what you call this. It's not dojo. In some shots, he appears to be wearing eyeliner also. Oh, now we remember all the people that died. And now we're ready for revenge for some fucking ninja on ninja action. Only a ninja can stop a ninja. Back to the Mockingjay necklace. We get it. He's totally wearing eyeliner, but only in some sequences. But again, ninjas were the coolest. I don't know if it was just their costume, if it was the wide variety of weapons they used, if it was the violence that always came along with them. But in the early 80s, I mean, growing up as a kid with cable, and I wasn't allowed to watch R-rated movies, but I had a friend who totally was. Parents were super lax. So anytime I was at his house, we were watching the worst shit. I mean, Nightmare on Elm Street, Revenge of the Nerds, Ninja 3, The Domination. If there was a ninja in it, we were going to watch it, you know. And Revenge of the Ninja was not a movie I ever came across. I think Ninja 3 was the only one as a kid that I saw. It wasn't even until recently. I saw Enter the Ninja a while back, but it wasn't until pretty recently that I saw Revenge of the Ninja. And it so quickly became a movie that I love so goddamn much. This is one of those movies I'm gonna have memorized, I guarantee you. Again, we have to fetishize the weapons. He's going to travel across. Once again, broad daylight. Couldn't do this shit under cover of night. That would be no good. Then the crew of Revenge of the Ninja would have to work a night. And this was clearly a 9-to-5 crew. Did you see him look around, by the way? He looked left and right. Breakaway glass. He looked left and right as he went across. Like, what? Was he looking for people? He's dozens of stories up in the air. What did he think he was going to find? So now we're already sort of into the final battle sequence, and it's a long one. When the ninja decides to take his revenge, it does not disappoint. It goes on for a while. Like, a long while, actually. Possibly too long. For some people, not for me. I'm never ready for Revenge of the Ninja to be over. Now he throws some micro machines down, which I like. And he hangs the heater over the doorknob. Watch out, wet bandit. Oh! Damn it. Would it not have been easier to just turn around and stab that dude? Instead, he had to throw two different kinds of things on the ground. And, when this is all over, is his plan to go back and collect them? Or does he have to buy more? Because that's wasteful. Another smoke grenade. Ah, there we go. Finally. I mean, the movie's almost over, and we just now got, like, our first severed limb. It's a fucking ninja movie. Arms and heads should be getting chopped off left and right. I saw my first severed limb in a movie at a very young age. We were visiting my aunt and uncle and my cousins, like in the sticks in Missouri. And my uncle rented a movie called White Fire. And in the first 5 minutes, a dude gets his arm lopped off, and that image is forever in my head. I believe my uncle was made to turn off the movie after the guy got his arm cut off in White Fire, a movie I have never seen since, but which I will never forget the name of. Again, the point of that is just to show different weapons, because what those didn't serve any function. Still death by hot tub here. It would be great, too, if this guy was just, like, pouring in carrots and potatoes and stuff. Revenge of the Ninja. You missed so many opportunities. And it's kind of another weird choice. Like, we know that he's scaling the building. We saw him put the things on his hands. We watched him start to scale it. Do we really need to check in on his progress every once in a while? Or if we saw him now enter the building, would we figure out... I don't know, whatever. That is truly, truly my favorite line in the movie. Goddamn son of a bitch ninja. If I could have like a longer Twitter handle, it would absolutely be goddamn son of a bitch ninja. And that actor said that with a straight face, too, which I love. Oh! He was carrying those in his mouth the whole time? That doesn't make any sense. But again, now we get sort of super violent again. So the movie opens with a ton of violence. And then there's like fighting and killing and stuff in the middle, but it's not all that violent. They appear to have saved a lot of it for the end, because the movie really delivers in this whole last sequence. And again, a lot of this stuff was cut out for the initial VHS release. Thank God it's been restored. Thank God! Surely there's a better way to kill a person, right? I don't know. I don't know why all of a sudden this guy becomes like a James Bond villain. Kane sees almost as much fighting action in this movie as Cho. Maybe the ninja in question in Revenge of the Ninja is Kane the ninja. Or maybe it was just a stipulation of Sho Kasugi's contract. Like, listen, I will do another ninja movie if my son has just as much to do. This is one of Kathy's better costumes. I'd put it just ahead of the red kimono with no pants. And now, I don't know. It's, like, getting worse. I don't know what it is. It's weird. Goddamn son of a bitch ninja. And these guys just stand here while they get fucking arrows. And who are these women? Where did they come from? They just stand there and watch and say, what the? Even though they're both holding giant machine guns long enough to get an arrow in their head. Now he gets his big Scarface moment. protects their pulse. Always the dutiful cop. See, we got a little dolly action there. Furstenberg. You formalist genius, you. If you guys have the subtitles on Netflix, by the way, they are outstanding, because a lot of times they describe not just the action, but the music. So for a second, it was Valiant instrumental music as Cho was making his run down the hallway. Other times it's been ominous, but this time it's Valiant. So that's kind of it for Dave, who had a gun this whole time and chose to only produce it after he'd been stabbed in the stomach. And is a terrible shot. And now has been stabbed and hit with a throwing star. But just has enough time for some great, like, I'm cold, man. I'm cold. Go get him, man. Goddamn son of a bitch ninja. So for some reason, you know, so much of the movie was building up to Braden's showdown with that kind of fake Joe Pesci dude. All we really saw of it was like him getting stabbed in the hand, and then it cut away. We can assume he's dead. But why that's not shown? But again, the 10-year-old kid's death is shown. I don't understand, but my point is we're finally at a point in the movie where everyone is dead, basically, except for our hero and our villain, so they can have a big showdown on a tennis court on the roof of a building. I don't think it's actually a tennis court, but see, I like how they're honorable here. The way of the ninja. Now, they did not do this. Oh, because they weren't fighting another ninja. That's why. I was going to say, they didn't do this every time they killed some other people, because it's almost like some Revolutionary War shit, like reloading your musket. It takes 20 minutes every time you're going to kill a guy. But I figured it out, F-heads. It's because they were not fighting another... If you're fighting another ninja, you got to do all this ceremonial shit. And again, Braden's still wearing the mask, which, you know, has to completely obstruct his vision. I mean, there's no way the guy can see anything behind that mask. But really, he wears it so that we can disguise the fact that it's actually a stuntman doing all of that action. Since Cho knows it's him, there's really no reason to still be wearing the mask. Different weapon every time. We have to keep showcasing new weapons. But again, now we have a little bit of some longer shots in which the action plays out. Even if it's just, like, flipping around and shit, at least you get a sense of these are guys that can do this stuff, you know? And again, maybe this really was written like they fight on the roof of the building. But since there's nothing particularly important about the geography of this roof, it just feels like it's what they had available. It's what somebody scouted, like, oh, hey, we can have the final showdown up here. Because it's basically just this big flat landscape. What? Braden had time to make a fake Braden and then attack Cho with a fake Braden made of wood. Where did he produce that from? He has not been carrying that around at any point during the movie. Somebody's cable reception's getting all fucked up now. Not cool, guys. If you know anything about the 180 degree rule, that sequence just violated it like 5 times. I mean, you knew somebody was coming out of there, right? There's no way. Is it just another wooden Braden? Yeah. Where's he getting all these fucking dummies? And how does he make them move? Oh, it's got circuitry. It's a robot. He built robots. I mean, the movie just goes off the rails crazy in this whole ending sequence. It keeps reinventing new rules for itself. Which is great. I'm kind of frustrated with myself because I have been silent too often, and I don't mean to be. Because when I listen to commentaries, I get very upset when the filmmaker is like silent for long stretches where I'm like, oh, they're just watching the movie. Part of it is because, you know, I wasn't involved with making Revenge of the Ninja, so I don't have like cool stories to tell. And part of it is, yeah, there is some piece of you that just gets wrapped up in what you're watching. I don't see how anybody could, you know, have Revenge of the Ninja on and not just fall under its spell every so often. But honestly, too, it's, you know, you run out of stuff to say. This is the kind of commentary you just, like, have on in the background. You don't actually listen to it really closely the whole way through. It's just like having somebody annoying sitting in the room with you talking throughout the movie. Not really saying anything you need to hear. I barely even made a dent in my popcorn here. And again, if you look at the landscape where it's just sort of big, flat, gray, with these giant obstructions every so often, like these big electrical boxes or whatever. Again, it reminds you of the final shootout at the end of Heat. Michael Mann, apparently a huge Revenge of the Ninja fan, because he's borrowing a lot from this movie. I don't actually think a lot of the things that I'm saying, by the way. In case this is the first time you're hearing me or anything F this movie related. Ouch. Now, Braden has a great death. Spoilers. He does not survive his confrontation. But this fight is way too long, right? I'm not crazy. This fight goes on and on and on, and I understand, again, it's like they want to deliver on the ninja-on-ninja action, but perhaps a more viable solution would have been have Cho become a ninja. That is fantastic, too. Have Cho become a ninja. How he managed that, I will never understand, but whatever. Have Cho become a ninja before the last few minutes of the movie. I'm almost positive the robe that Kathy put on earlier was green. Suddenly now it's blue. And the cops arrive at the building, but the civilians are allowed to enter, no problem. So we could have had way more ninja action if we would have just had Cho be a ninja for longer in the movie. But again, his character arc was such that he did not want to be a ninja. He had sworn off the way of the ninja. He's sort of forced into it when he realizes he has to take down the man he thought was his friend. It's fucking Shakespearean, Revenge of the Ninja. Goddamn son of a bitch ninja. And sometimes I feel like they're the worst ninjas. Like he's literally just stabbing at Cho on the ground and missing him. I will blind him. All right, we're coming up on... Oh, now he shoots fire, by the way, too. That's a thing he can do. It does nothing. It's to no purpose. But the movie just keeps making up new rules. But yeah, we're coming up on the money shot. Literally, I mean. It's, well, you'll see. There it is. What? How does that happen? Just a fucking geyser of blood spewing out of the man. Apparently Brayden's anatomy is such that he has one giant artery running right through his chest. I mean, that honestly, that would have been at home in like a Monty Python movie. But I love how bloody they make his death. There's something satisfying about that. Still clutching the Mockingjay. Now, a truly great movie would have these two guys fight. Ooh, the subtitle says redeemed instrumental music. Whatever the fuck that sounds like. Redeemed instrumental music? If I'm deaf or hard of hearing, I'm not sure I can picture what redeemed instrumental music sounds like. Now the robe is somewhere between blue and green, so perhaps it's just a color timing issue. And that's it. That's the end of the movie. They hug on the roof while Brayden lays there dead. And that, my friends, is Revenge of the Ninja. If you liked it, I would advise... I mean, you could go back and see Enter the Ninja, because that movie has a lot of great ninja action, and it's also super ridiculously violent, and it has Shokusugi in it. But Ninja 3, The Domination, is the other one that's directed by Sam Furstenberg, so it brings his special directorial flair, if you want to call it that. I think this movie is so entertaining and so much fun. Again, in an unironic way, it's bad, right? I mean, we can sort of agree on that, but I guess that just depends on how you quantify bad, because if you're going to say a bad movie is one in which you do not have a good time, one in which you are not entertained, then no, Revenge of the Ninja is not a bad movie at all. It's bad by ways that we sort of, you know, measure like, oh, well, it's not well acted and it's not particularly well directed and stuff. You know, on those levels, on sort of on a filmmaking level, I guess it's bad. But what it adds up to is this very crazy, special thing that I really, really enjoy. I really appreciate you guys sitting here. If you've made it to the end, my hat is off to you. I don't wear a hat, but I really appreciate you guys sitting here and listening to me just barely talk my way through Revenge of the Ninja. Remember, you can always find us at fthismovie.blogspot.com. We have a Facebook page you can like at facebook.com/fthismovie. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Again, usually there's more of us on the show. It's not just me talking. And we have over 100 shows in the iTunes store. We have a few other commentaries I mentioned earlier. Mostly we do podcasts. But check us out, and hopefully you'll like what you hear. I had a great time watching this movie, and thank you guys so much for listening to me talk my way through it. Goddamn son of a bitch ninja. That gong. I mean, it's so racist.